Okay. Let's situate ourselves, get our little butzos in the seatso. Butzo means butt, by the way, in some kind of language. Pretty big dude. Pretty big dude there. It's called big dude. Big dude. What do you do when you see a big dude? Sir. You use the word sir. Yeah. Okay. Let's continue on with lymph nodes. Remember, we went through probably the most important thing, and that is that when they describe painful lymphadenopathy, what does that mean? It's some inflammatory condition. It does not mean malignant. Okay? Okay? And if it's painless in general, what does that mean? Malignant. And what's the most common malignancy of a lymph node? Metastasis. What's the most common cancer, primary cancer of a lymph node? Malignant non-Hodgkin's malignant lymphoma. What actually is that? Is that that tumor? It's a follicular B-cell lymphoma. Anybody remember the translocation? 1418. And what essentially happened when you did that translocation? You knocked off the apoptosis gene, and so now that cell is immortal. Not immortal, immortal. There you go. That Brooklyn accent always comes in there, immortal. Yeah. You hear my sister, she lives out in Huntington Station, out in Suffolk. God almighty, what an accent. Who? You live there in Huntington Station? Would you come in by train? Oh, you fly in? That's really cool. That's cool. Okay, Hodgkin's disease. There's four types. You only need to know one. And that's the most common one. And interestingly, it's more common in women than men, whereas all the other types are more common in men than in women. It's called nodular sclerosing Hodgkin's. And it actually means what it says, nodular. I mean, it is a low power of a lymph node with nodular sclerosing. I think you get this nodular appearance, so that makes sense. Sclerosis means lots of, you know, collagen deposition. Well, that's what all this pink crap is in here. So you can see this would be a hard, non-painful node. And here's how you're going to recognize. Very, very simple to recognize Hodgkin's disease. It'll usually be a woman, at least we're talking about boards, and she'll have lymph node involvement in two places. Okay? One is always the anterior mediastinum. Okay? So one of those locations is nodes in the anterior mediastinum. The second is somewhere above the diaphragm. It could be in the cervical nodes, it could be a supraclavicular node, something like that. So it's in two different places. One is in the anterior mediastinum and the other is somewhere in one other area above the diaphragm, neck, supraclavicular, something like that. So they describe a woman. They take this one over here. You can see that she obviously has it in the neck over here, and I can guarantee you she has an anterior mediastinal mass also. That combination of a mass in the anterior mediastinum and a non-painful lymph node in the neck is not just sclerosing Hodgkin's, period. Okay? This is what it looks like here. You don't have to know that crap about lacunar cells and all that stuff. That's for pathology residents, not for board examinations. So what's the malignant cell actually in Hodgkin's disease? The Reed-Sternberg cell. That's this little dude right here. That's a common picture on boards, guys. It's a common picture on boards. That's it for nodular sclerosing. Look, that's nice. It just fell out of my hand and it went ahead. This is cool. I like this. I'm not going to go through the entire meaning of a serum protein electrophoresis other than to say that albumin is the one that migrates the furthest because it has the most negative charges, whereas gamma globulin is kind of like a couch potato. You know, it's just where they apply the serum, it just sits there. Okay, I want you to be familiar with two terms, polyclonal, monoclonal, so that you understand the difference between multiple myeloma and other kinds of things that increase the gamma globulin peak. What's poly mean? Many, okay? Clonal, many clones. Many clones of what? Plasma cells. Because the gamma globulin region is where your gamma globulins are. Now, what's the first three letters of gamma? G, A, M, right? Well, that's the order of the greatest amount, G. The second most is A. The third most is M, and D and E are way down there. So that's an easy way of remembering what's the most abundant globulin. So when we do a protein electrophoresis, and we look in this ganoglobulin region, when we see a little peak, we know that it has to be an increase in IgG, because that's the most abundant immunoglobulin. And think about it. Didn't you tell me that in chronic inflammation, the primary immunoglobulin was IgG? Remember, in acute inflammation, the primary immunoglobulin was IgM. And so when you have chronic inflammation, rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, things like that, and where you have increase in IgG, well, that's going to cause the gamma globulin region to show this big diffuse elevation, like this, like a round mountain. This is called polyclonal gammopathy. That's because many, many benign plasma cells are making IgG, some are making IgM, whatever. But lots of different clones of plasma cells are making their thing. And so you get this diffuse elevation of that peak. So polyclonal gammopathy means what? First of all, it means benign. What else does it mean? Chronic inflammation, period. You're not going to have a polyclonal gammopathy in acute inflammation. You have acute appendicitis, there's not going to be anything. You're not going to see a single thing happen in the gamma globulin region, because the main immunoglobulin is IgM. Remember, that's the third most abundant one, so you're not going to do anything. But when you have chronic inflammation, and you got all that IgG that's being made, that will cause a diffuse elevation of the gamma globulin peak, and that's called polyclonal gammopathy. Always means benign, and always means chronic inflammation. Now, monoclonal, you wouldn't want to sit on that sucker, that's for sure. Okay, monoclonal gammopathy, what does that mean? One clone of plasma cells are making immunoglobulin. Well, how could that be? What's to keep the other ones from making immunoglobulin if they're suppressed? So when you see a monoclonal peak like you see here, that usually almost always means malignancy. Malignancy of what? A plasma cell. And all the other plasma cells are suppressed by immunologic mechanisms. So they're suppressed. Whereas one clone, the malignant clone of plasma cells, makes its immunoglobulin. And because it's just one clone of plasma cells, you get and most of the time it's an IgG malignancy. They make lots of immunoglobulin, they make lots of light chains. The light chains oftentimes get into the urine, and what's that called? Bench-Jones protein, good. So make sure you know the difference between polyclonal and monoclonal. Now while I have this up here, let's just do another one that's not related to this. This is albumin. Do you know what the next peak is? Alpha 1, alpha 2, beta, and gamma. Just for fun. Let's say you had a person that 25, 26, non-smoker, had emphysema in the lower lobes, and you saw a protein electrophoresis, and there was no, this peak, this was gone. It was just flat. There was no alpha 1 peak. What would you diagnose this peak? Alpha 1 antitrypsin deficiency. That's pretty cool, huh? Okay. So polyclonal means benign and means chronic inflammation. Monoclonal usually means malignant, and we're talking about multiple myeloma. Okay, that's what we're going to talk about now. This has all the interesting things. Two pictures up here are key pictures. Both of these pictures have been on boards. Multiple myeloma is a horrible, horrible disease. It's basically incurable, unless you get some kind of bone marrow transplant or something like that. It's incurable. My mother-in-law died of this. Not a very nice disease. Usually you see this in people over 50, so it's not a young person's disease. A little bit more common in women than men. Most common type is an Ig kappa, a type of multiple myeloma. Remember that plasma cells have interleukin-1. Another name for interleukin-1 is osteoclast activating factor. So take a look at this skull over here. Okay, do you see lots of lytic lesions in here, don't you? Huh? See them? See them? Okay. Notice they're pretty cookie cutter. They're not like irregular borders to them. Okay, they're nice and pretty much round. Looks like, you know, someone just took something, just like that. Nice, neat cut. And Paget's disease of bone isn't nice and neat. Paget's disease of bone also has lytic areas, but they're very, very fuzzy looking. So there's no way that you could confuse Paget's disease of bone with multiple myeloma. This is multiple myeloma. Nice cookie cutter, sharp borders to the lytic areas. That's because interleukin-1 activates osteoclasts, and so they just bore a hole through the bone there, and they produce these lytic areas. So obviously, if this was, let's say, in a rib, and you coughed, what could potentially happen if you had a lytic lesion in a rib? your fracture. So pathologic fractures are extremely common. The one I usually like on board is an elderly woman, let's say, who coughs and she develops severe pain. Okay? She comes in and you see there's some point tenderness over the rib. They do an x-ray and they see a lytic lesion with a pathologic fracture there. And then they ask you, what's the patient have? Multiple myeloma. That's the way they usually ask it on boards. Okay. Take a good look. You've seen this picture before. Take a good look at what a plasma cell looks like. There is no way you should ever confuse a plasma cell with any other cell. Okay? It's basically a cell that has a bright blue cytoplasm. Very, very few cells have bright blue cytoplasm. Notice the nucleus is eccentrically located. Notice that usually right next to the nucleus, this little clear area is present. Okay? If it did an electron microscopy of that cell, what would you see? What would be the characteristic thing you'd see in the cytosol? Can't you remember it from the inflammation lectures? What did it look like? They had these little layers. Remember, layers and layers of what? Smooth endoplasmic reticulum? No. What was it? Ribosomes, rough endoplasmic reticulum. Remember, there were just sheets and sheets of it. Why? Because it's constantly making protein. Remember, ribosomes is what ribosomal RNA sits on, huh? Okay? So very, very important that you know what a plasma cell looks like on an H&E stain. I mean a right Kingston stain, and also on a electron microscope. Very important. Okay. Multiple myeloma. Lytic lesions, elderly patient, Bench-Jones protein. That's the key things you want to remember. This is what amyloid looks like on electron microscopy. Notice it's a non-branching linear compound. Notice it has a hole in the center of it. They usually ask maybe one or two questions on amyloidosis because it always seems to end up in a differential diagnosis for multi-system disease. You always have to put systemic amyloidosis down there as a possibility. It's very interesting. Amyloid is a protein. You all know that. But what's interesting is that many different kinds of proteins can be converted into it. Okay? So it's a unique protein. But many different kinds of protein are transformed into this unique protein. Okay, for example, prealbumin can be converted into amyloid. You told me I think it was yesterday, you told me about calcitonin, the tumor marker for medullary carcinoma of the thyroid. It can be converted into amyloid. Okay, light chains in multiple myeloma can be converted into amyloid. And what if I had trisomy 21? What does chromosome 21 code for? Beta amyloid protein. So if you had three chromosome 21s, then you'd make a little bit more beta amyloid, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you? Okay, now do you happen to know what beta amyloid protein does? It's toxic to neurons. And so if you had trisomy 21 and you're making more beta amyloid protein, then you're obviously going to be losing more neurons because there's more of this protein that is toxic to neurons. This is why they always ask the question about the person that dies at age 40 and an autopsy is done and reveals atrophy in the brain and reveals senile plaques in the frontal and temporal lobe. They call them senile plaques. When we get to CNS, I'll show you what they are. And then I'll ask you, who's the patient? And the answer is Down syndrome. See, Down syndrome patients will all get Alzheimer's disease if they happen to live that long. They either die of one of two things. They die in and around childhood from their cardiac disease, endocardial cushion defects, which is a combination of an atrial septal and ventricular septal defect. Either that's what usually gets them as a kid. But if they manage to live, to 35, 40 years of age, they all get Alzheimer's. That's because of that excess chromosome 21 making excess beta amyloid and producing Alzheimer's disease. Always asked. Always asked. So a 40-year-old with Alzheimer's disease is who? A child with a patient with Down syndrome. That is correct. Good. That's about it for amyloid. There's not much more important in it. The key thing is to remember the beta amyloid. That's probably the most important one to remember for Alzheimer's disease. I just put these two things in just for fun because you're having biochemistry coming up and you'll be discussing lysosomal storage diseases. Okay? These are two favorite cells that they like to put on examinations that deal with this because it relates to biochemistry. This is a macrophage. It's got this kind of crinkly, paper-like, wrinkled type of appearance in the cytoplasm. I will tell you that the lysosomes are filled with glucocerebroside. So therefore, what would the disease be on that top one? Gaucher is very good. An autosomal recessive disease where they're missing glucocerebrosidase. Therefore, they can't break down glucocerebroside. Very good. So take another look at it, kind of a wrinkled cytoplasm. Kind of like you took paper and really wrinkled it up. Now take a look at the bottom one. So you get the appearance of feeling as bubbly looking, huh? Kind of bubbles. It's just kind of like, it looks like little bubbles in there. Okay, this patient has a cherry red macula. Tay-Sachs disease. Okay, no, wrong. Excuse me, I was wrong. Forget the cherry red macula. I was wrong. This patient has severe mental retardation, and I'll tell you that the buildup product in the lysosomes is sphingomyelin. Niemann-Pick. Okay, no, Niemann-Pick's disease. Sorry, I screwed up on that Tay-Sachs thing. Niemann-Pick's doesn't have a cherry red macula, but it does have severe mental retardation, and they're missing sphingomyelinase, so sphingomyelin is the thing that's increased. Okay. Who can tell me the only glycogen storage disease that is lysosomal storage? Is it von Gierke's? No. Is it McArdle's? No. You're saying nothing because you don't know what any of these are, right? Okay. Is it Pompe's? Yes. Pompe's is the only glycogen storage disease that's lysosomal storage because it's missing an enzyme to break glycogen down in the lysosomes. Anybody remember how they die, patients with Pompe's disease? Cardiac. They get excess deposition of normal glycogen in the heart, and that's what kills them. Okay. Good. So what's the name of this disease with the bubbly cytoplasm? Niemann-Pick's. What's the one with the wrinkled-up cytoplasm? Gaucher's. Very good. Both are examples of lysosomal storage diseases. Okay. Coagulation. Coagulation. Here's another bugaboo. Most students, when they went through coagulation, oh, God, you had all that cascade system and all that stuff. I'm going to really try to totally confuse you with it because I'm going to use the most complex slide I can think of to teach you that. Okay? It's so complex, it's just literally, you just can't possibly understand it. Okay? Look at all those things all over the place. I have such a complicated-looking slide, kind of like a Netter slide. You know? Okay. But anyway, let's get back to some normal stuff before we get into coagulation system. Let's talk about hemostasis. Let's talk about things in our body that prevent little clots from developing in our small blood vessels. That would not be a nice thing, that little clots developing in your small blood vessels, because if they did, you'd probably have either DIC or thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura or hemolytic uremic syndrome, and you would not be here. Okay, you would die from those things. Those are bad things. So how come we don't form clots in our small blood vessels? Now, when I say small blood vessel, I'm talking arterioles, venules, capillaries. That's what a small blood vessel is. Anybody know what a small airway is? So we're talking about small. Terminal bronchial, respiratory bronchial, alveolar duct, alveolus. Those are small airways. Small vessels, arterioles, venules, capillaries. Okay. All right, so how come we don't form clots? And we have a couple things in here. We have heparin. We have heparin? Yeah. It's a glycosaminoglycan. Heparin is a glycosaminoglycan. Okay? It's a GAG. It's a mucopolysaccharide. Okay? And so, yeah, we have that normally in our bodies, and it's helping us, preventing us from forming clots. How does heparin work? It enhances antithrombin 3. And where is antithrombin 3 made? Liver, just like all other proteins are. So actually, heparin gets all the credit for anticoagulating you, but it's actually antithrombin 3 that does all the work. Because antithrombin 3 basically neutralizes most of the coagulation factors. And so that's, so we have a little bit of heparin in our small vessels that prevents clotting from occurring. Normally, we have PGI2, prostacycline. That's, of course, made by endothelial cells. Okay, remember, it's a vasodilator. See, when you vasodilate a small vessel and blood flow is increased, it's hard for things to stick. It's hard for a thrombus to develop because it gets blown away so fast. So vasodilatation is very, very antagonistic to forming thrombi in anything. It's too fast. Everything's moving too quickly. So that's how and also it prevents platelet aggregation. So that's helping us. We also have protein CNS. These are actually vitamin K-dependent factors. Okay, now you all know about 2, 7, 9, and 10, but you always forget protein C and protein S. Well, what do they do normally, protein C and protein S? They inactivate, not activate, inactivate. In other words, get rid of, neutralize two things, factors 5 and 8. Factor 5 and 8. So they actually inhibit factor 5 and 8 in our circulation, which is interesting because antithrombin 3 can't inhibit those. Antithrombin 3 can only inhibit what we call serine proteases, and factor 5 and factor 8 are not serine proteases. So isn't it interesting that we have protein C and protein S to take care of 5 and 8 because antithrombin 3 can't. So it's protecting us. This is good. Okay, and then we have tissue plasminogen activator, the very thing that we use in trying to dissolve a clot in a patient with a coronary thrombosis. Remember, tissue plasminogen activator activates plasminogen, which produces what? Plasmin. And plasmin just eats everything in sight, like we do sometimes in a frenzy. Okay? We'll talk about our little friend plasmin in a little bit. So these dudes are all working for us to prevent little clots from developing in our small blood vessels. And so just a very simple question. What if all of these things were deficient, or any one of these things would be deficient? And what do you think would happen? You'd form clots. So in other words, if I didn't have heparin around, form a clot. If I didn't have PGA to form, if I was deficient in protein CNS, I'd form a clot. If I was deficient in tissue plasminogen activator, I'd be thrombogenic. Understand? Why is a birth control pill thrombogenic? Because it increases the synthesis of 5 and 8, that's one reason. Increases fibrinogen, that's another reason. And it inhibits antithrombin 3. So birth control pills, in a sense, are acting like heparin. I mean, they're not acting like heparin. They're an antagonist of heparin. They're blocking, inhibiting antithrombin 3 from doing its job. That's why any woman on a birth control pill, the estrogen in that birth control pill is producing a little bit of, it's inhibiting things and increasing the synthesis of other things that potentiate you from forming a clot. The birth control pills of today have less estrogen in them than ones in the past, and so the risk is a little bit less, but it's still there. It's still a risk because of the estrogen in a birth control pill. That makes women thrombogenic. Let me tell you the deadly duo. You are a woman, and you're on a birth control pill, and you're smoking, you're asking for it. You're really, really asking for it, because you're gonna get a thrombus, clear as a bell. As a matter of fact, read the warning labels on the birth control pills, and it said, do not smoke on there. It's a contraindication to smoke. Because smoking is, in itself, thrombogenic because of damaged endothelial cells. And you throw on top of that birth control pills, you're asking for it. Big time. Big time. Contraindication. Not supposed to do those two at the same time. No, 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 no. Very, very bad. Not good, not good, not good. Okay, now, let's talk about, let's say I was shaving this morning. Okay, anyway, cut myself. Okay? What's going to stop the bleeding from those little small vessels that I just cut across with my razor? Okay, that's what we're going to talk about now. Okay? How do we stop bleeding when we cut small vessels? Now, we're not talking about arteries. Okay? We're not talking about muscular arteries, cutting a hole in one of those things. You're going to have to put some kind of, you know, tourniquet around that to stop that sucker. Okay? But we're talking about you injure, you cut, you damage a small vessel, arterial, capillary, venial. What stops the bleeding? Okay, now that's what we're going to talk about. And we're going to do it by kind of killing two birds with one stone here. You know, two heads fall off the birds. We're going to use the bleeding time as an example because the bleeding time is a commonly used test, and I will tell you what the test is used for. It's used to evaluate platelet function. That's its main use for the bleeding time. I will also tell you this. If I had hemophilia A and had zero factor A, I'd have a normal bleeding time. So what did I just tell you? It has absolutely nothing to do with coagulation factors. Absolutely nothing. It's purely a platelet thing. Okay? A platelet thing that controls the bleeding time. I want to get that out in front first. The test is done by cleaning off an area, usually on the volar aspect of the forearm. And then they have this little template with these two little blades in it, okay, which are hidden. You know, most people don't like you coming at it with knives and stuff like that or little blades. What are you going to do with that? Well, I'm going to inflict a little wound over you. Oh, no, you're not. They're out of there. Okay, but you got to tell them, you know, you're going to put this thing on over there and it's going to produce a little 1 millimeter. How big is that? Ooh, just that little tiny little thing. Okay, wound. and you're going to have some bleeding there. Okay, we're going to do a bleeding timer. Probably won't hurt you. Don't put it over a big, giant vein, though. Not a good idea. Not a good idea. Try to find some place where it doesn't look too blue underneath there, okay? And so, you inflict this wound, okay? You start a stopwatch. You got to have a piece of filter paper, and every 30 seconds, you dab that wound, and when no blood comes off on that filter paper, stop the stopwatch, end the bleeding time. Usually it's about like 7 to 9 minutes, okay, and then it's finished. Okay, so we're going to go through what happened there, and then we're even going to go a little bit beyond after the bleeding time is over. We'll go a little bit beyond. You'll see how this whole thing works normally. Okay, so we cut the vessel. That's going to release tissue thromboplastin right off the bat. When you damage tissue, whatever, you cut across tissue, tissue thromboplastin will be released. And yes, that does activate the extrinsic coagulation system, but you'll find out that has nothing to do with the bleeding time. But it starts the coagulation system going. That's true. It does do that. Okay, what else is going to happen? Well, I'm going to expose collagen in that wound. And, of course, factor 12 is activated. Hageman's factor is activated by exposed collagen. So we're going to even start off the intrinsic system, but it won't have anything to do with the bleeding time. It does something later, after the bleeding time is over. Okay, what else is going to happen? Well, endothelial cells, as well as megakaryocytes, make a certain adhesion product. In other words, a glue whose special purpose is to stick to platelets. Name me. Von Willebrand's factor. So von Willebrand's factor, which is part of the factor VIII molecule, actually is made in two places. It's made in the megakaryocyte and the bone marrow, and it's also made in the endothelial cells, normally. So what's made from megakaryocytes, please? Platelets. So platelets actually carry a little bit of glue with them in these little granules. So platelets carry a little glue with them, okay? And it's also made in the endothelial cells. You understand so far? So when you damage these small blood vessels, von Willebrand's factor is exposed, okay? All right. And so platelets, guess what, have receptors. Just like neutrophils have receptors for adhesion molecules made by the endothelial cell, so do platelets have receptors for von Willebrand's factor, which is basically an adhesion molecule. This is the concept, guys. If neutrophils can't stick to venules, then how will they be able to get out and go to where they're supposed to go to kill bugs? They can't. You have to stick before you can get out of the vessel. It's a similar concept here. Platelets have to stick before they can do their thing. They have to. And so von Willebrand's factor is that adhesion molecule that allows it to do that. Okay? So now the platelet sticks. That's called platelet adhesion. That's cool. All right? Now what happens? Well, when it sticks, it causes the platelet to release chemicals. It causes the platelet to release chemicals. Do you need to know all the 20 of them? No. You only need to know the most important chemical for what we're talking about, and that's ADP. Adenosine, not triphosphate, diphosphate. And that's a potent aggregating agent. That causes platelets to begin sticking together and starting to help form a thrombus in that little injured vessel that's going to begin to stop the bleeding. Okay, but it's not enough to do the whole thing. So this is called the release reaction. The release reaction. When it sticks, that stimulates the platelet to release chemicals. The one that we need to remember is ADP. And it's going to start causing platelets that are coming by to start kind of sticking together and kind of blocking up that injured lumen and maybe stop some of this bleeding. Okay? But it's still not enough. It needs one more chemical before it will really, really stop the bleeding. And you already probably figured it out. As soon as that platelet has its release reaction, it begins synthesizing its own unique substance. Okay, and what is that unique substance that platelets can make, please? Thromboxane A2. And the reason why it makes it is because it's the only cell in the entire body that has thromboxane synthase. It's the only one that does. And so it can convert PGH2 into thromboxane A2. Now, what does thromboxane A2 do? And boy, you better know all three functions because all have been asked on boards. It's a potent vasoconstrictor. Potent. Potent. Why is that so important for stopping bleeding? Because if you slow up the rate of blood flow, it makes it easier for platelets to stick together. They don't get washed away. I mean, it makes sense. As opposed to prostacyclin, which is a vasodilator, you get a vasodilator, you really think, honestly, that a platelet could stick to exposed injury? No way. It gets blown right away. But when it's vasoconstriction and blood is flowing very, very slowly, it makes it way easier to do that. It is a potent vasoconstrictor. As a matter of fact, it's what causes the vasoconstriction of a coronary artery in Prince Metal's angina, as a matter of fact. So it even has other things that the little sucker does. What else does it do? Well, it's also a bronchoconstrictor. So it actually has some activity in asthmatics. Kind of helps LTC4, D4E4 along. Okay, so we have a vasoconstrictor, a bronchoconstrictor, and a platelet aggregator par excellence. It puts the finishing touches on it. It will cause those platelets to really aggregate. And it blocks up that lumen of the injured vessels. Bleeding time has just ended. Okay, bleeding time is finished now. Once that thromboxane A2 is released. But before we go ahead on this thing, there's an integration here. I want to see if you can pick it up. Platelets did two interesting things that another cell that I'm thinking about also does. First, remember, platelets had a release reaction where chemicals that were already made in it were released. So preformed chemicals were released. Okay? And then it made its own unique chemical called thromboxane A2 a little bit later. Does that remind you of any cell that you learn about in immunology? Let's try a mast cell, guys. Let's try a mast cell. Didn't it have, remember when there were two IgEs next juxtaposed to each other and a pollen kind of bridged the gap like an electrical circuit? What happened to the mast cell, please? It had a release reaction. Of what? Preformed chemicals. Which ones? Histamine, serotonin, eosinophil chemotactic factor. And didn't that start the process going of the inflammatory reaction and a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction? Yes or no? Okay. And then what happened later? What did the mast cell do? It activated the released arachidonic acid from its membrane, okay? And we ended up making prostaglandins and leukotrienes, right? And they were released maybe 30 minutes to an hour later. Okay, isn't that true? And that kind of furthered and enhanced that inflammatory reaction, which we associate with type 1 hypersensitivity reactions. So release reaction of preformed elements, and then make your own prostaglandins and leukotrienes as a later effect. But platelets kind of do the same thing. They have a release reaction too. Okay, and then they make thromboxane A2 as for a little bit later. So there's an analogy there. You want to remember that. You want to remember that. Okay, let's screw this bleeding time up, and then we'll continue on with, we're not done yet with what happens to that little plug, because that little plug is very, very temporary. Let me tell you what it is. All it is a bunch of platelets stuck together and held together by fibrin. Fibrin is carried by every platelet. And so basically, it's held together by fibrinogen. So there's fibrinogen draped over this, these platelets that are stuck together. Now it's enough to prevent bleeding and stop the bleeding time. But if I went like this, okay, I'd start bleeding again. So it's not a very, very stable platelet plug. Okay, just a bunch of platelets stuck together, draped over, you got this fibrinogen draping over it. Okay? Now let's screw up the bleeding time. What would be one obvious cause of a prolonged bleeding time? Thrombocytopenia. Don't go to the immediate ones. Okay, just go to, okay, you have a low platelet count. If you have less than 90,000 platelets, you're going to have a prolonged bleeding time. You don't have enough to aggregate. So that's one reason. Give me another one that deals with some adhesion molecule defect. Von Willebrand's disease. Actually, that's the most common genetic hereditary disease. It's autosomal dominant. One in 250 people have von Willebrand's disease, which means there's a good chance that one person in this room has von Willebrand's disease. Okay, good. You went to the money, didn't you? Well, right off the bat, you said, take an aspirin. Okay, that's the most common cause of prolonged bleeding time. What was the mechanism of that? Let me just make sure you understand what the mechanism is. Okay, aspirin, does that block platelet cycle oxygenase or does it block thromboxane synthase? It blocks platelet cycle oxygenase. Thromboxane synthase is blocked by dipyramidol. Now, maybe you haven't figured this out. Maybe our little friend with the English accent didn't tell you this. Well, endothelial cells have cyclooxygenase too. So how come the aspirin didn't inhibit the endothelial cell cyclooxygenase from making PGI2? Well, the answer to the question really is that the platelet cyclooxygenase versus the endothelial cell cyclooxygenase reacts differently to aspirin. They're basically different compounds that react differently to nonsteroidals. It's a 9-to-1 type of ratio. There's a 9 times greater inhibition of platelet cyclooxygenase when you take aspirin and or other nonsteroidals versus inhibition of the endothelial cell cyclooxygenase. That's the answer to that question. Okay? Because if we neutralize both of those things, we'd end up really screwed up. It wouldn't help us at all. So just aspirin and nonsteroidals just inhibit predominantly platelet cyclooxygenase, not cyclooxygenase in other cells. Okay. Aspirin, is it reversible or irreversible? Irreversible. Okay. Other nonsteroidals, reversible or irreversible? Reversible. How many hours? 48 hours. 48 hours it's reversible. Now let me just tell you what we just said here. If you took one little baby aspirin because you just went out after yesterday and I said, you know, you go on an aspirin today, you won't get strokes and myocardial infarctions and colon cancer. Maybe some of you said, I'm going to take aspirin from now on. Let me tell you something. None of your platelets work right now. Not a single stinking one of them. Really? Nope. And if you cut yourself shaving this morning, it's not going to stop bleeding in 9 minutes. Maybe 15, 20 minutes. Okay? Now, men, here's a major difference between men and women right here, when we cut ourselves. What do men use to stop the bleeding? Toilet paper. We always do. Okay. What do women use? Kleenex. Why? It's just a thing. It's a woman thing. Men use toilet paper. Women use Kleenex. I don't know why, but that's the way it is. Okay, you see some guy cut himself all over the place, got toilet paper all over him. All over. Okay, women, they just got the Kleenex. They wouldn't even think of using toilet paper. No. Major difference between a male and a female, right there. Okay. So if you're not sure when you look at somebody, you male or female, just ask him, when you cut yourself, what do you use? Well, I use toilet paper. Okay, brother, all right. You can give a strong handshake then, you know what I mean? Kleenex? No. Now, if a guy is using Kleenex, you're strongest suspect. That's not a male thing, I can tell you that for a fact. All right. Real men use toilet paper. Don't say I never taught you anything. That's very big time. Very big time. Okay. So aspirin works by blocking platelet cycle oxygenase and preventing platelets from aggregating. If there's no thromboxane A2 there, it's just not going to work, and so you'll continue bleeding. Okay? All right, now let's continue the story, because it's not over yet. And it's going to also help us in understanding the signs and symptoms of a platelet deficiency versus coagulation factor deficiency. Okay, now, remember we said that right off the bat when we did our test, that we released tissue thromboplastin and it activated the extrinsic system, and it activated Hageman's factor 12 because of collagen being exposed, so we activated the intrinsic system. And what's the end product of the coagulation system? Thrombin. And what's thrombin supposed to do? Convert what? Fibrinogen into fibrin. Okay, can you put it together now? What do we have now so far? We got a pile of platelets stuck together and draped over them is fibrinogen. Okay, so what do you think is going to happen just a little bit later after the bleeding time is over? That thrombin that's generated initially by the extrinsic and intrinsic system will convert the fibrinogen that's draping, that's holding these platelets together loosely into fibrin. And it's going to that's going to kind of make it a stable platelet plug in there that you would not be able to dislodge. Okay? You understand that? Okay. So who's going to remove that little platelet plug from the vessel? Plasminogen will be activated, plasmin will be formed, it'll drill a hole through it, and then eventually recanalize, and our vessels look totally normal. Okay, so in other words, when we do the bleeding time goes up to the formation of a temporary hemostatic plug. We've got a pile of platelets stuck together, draped together with fibrinogen. It stops the bleeding time, but it's very, very unstable. It would fall away very easily. And then when the coagulation system makes its thrombin, it will convert the fibrinogen that's draping it together, convert it to fiber. Now we have a strong platelet plug. Very important, otherwise you'll never understand the signs and symptoms that differentiate a platelet abnormality versus a coagulation factor deficiency. Right there, I gave you the answer. I want the answer now. I can tell you what the answer is while you're thinking about it. If I have a platelet problem, okay, what's my bleeding time going to be? Prolonged, good. And if I cut myself, if I cut little small vessels, what's going to happen? Are they going to stop bleeding or are they going to continue to bleed? Continue to bleed. So that's one of the major things that one sees with platelet abnormalities, bleeding from superficial scratches or cuts. You just continue to bleed. Why? Because you can't form a temporary hemostatic plug. In addition, you screw up the integrity of the small vessels whenever you screw around with platelets. And so you get petechia, little pinpoint areas of hemorrhage is another. It's only seen in a platelet abnormality. Petechia's little pinpoint area of hemorrhage of a little capillary. You'll get ecchymoses or purpura, a little greater area of hemorrhage into the tissue, that's seen. And epistaxis, you'll have nosebleeds. In fact, that's the most common of all the manifestations of a platelet problem. Listen, guys, none of the things I just said, petechia, ecchymoses, epistaxis, or bleeding from superficial scratches, occurs in a coagulation deficiency. None of them. Okay, so let's say you had hemophilia A, and you were deficient in factor A. What would your bleeding time be? Normal. Okay? So what kind of problems did they run into? Late rebleeding. Late rebleeding. What do you mean? You got an appendectomy. Okay? Everything went fine. You woke up, it started moving around, and blood started coming out. I mean, massive amounts of blood started coming out of the wound, and you bled to death. Because what was the only thing that was really holding your small vessels together? Well, sutures, and what else? Temporary hemostatic plugs. You see, if you have a coagulation factor deficiency, you can't convert the fibrinogen into fibrin, and so those little platelet things are just going to fall away. So you get late rebleeding. Well, you can handle superficial scratches and superficial cuts, no problem. Okay? But they're not going to hold that vessel closed for too long. They're going to be dislodged, and you're going to start bleeding again. You know what the best question to ask a person to see if they have a coagulation factor deficiency? Mrs. Jones, have you ever had a molar tooth removed, a wisdom tooth removed? Yes, I have. Okay. So you say, this is good, because now I'm going to find out whether she has a coagulation factor deficiency. Did you have any problems with bleeding with it? No. You just checked off a coagulation factor deficiency. They don't have one. Why? Because it has been said that if you don't have a bleeding problem after extracting a wisdom tooth, that actually imposes the greatest hemostatic stress on your system that exists. It's even worse than a thoracotomy or other types of surgical procedures on you. And so that's why that's the best question to ask, because they had no problem with bleeding. They have absolutely perfectly normal coagulation system. And you always want to ask that question. Okay. Now I want you to think what would happen if you had your wisdom tooth extracted today. Okay, you got some dude over there that's got you all numbed up, and he's got a little epinephrine in there. Okay, that's going to help. Okay, no vasoconstrict. And they're going to pack it a little bit, right? But let's say you had hemophilia A, mild case, and he didn't know it, or she didn't know it, that did that tooth extract. Okay? So, no problems. Hemostasis control. Well, what's the only thing holding your blood vessels shut? Little temporary platelet plugs held together by fibrinogen. Not fibrin, fibrinogen. What do they always tell you to do when you go home? Rinse your mouth out. Okay, preferably with a little salt, you know, maybe stick a little peroxide in there. So you do. Okay. And that was your last move, buddy. That was your last move, because now you're going to bleed to death and suffocate on your own blood, and that's the way you die. All those temporary hemostatic plugs are gone, because you just blew them away by that, and you're going to bleed, it'll go down into your throat, and a lot of people just literally choke to death on their own blood. It's that serious. So it's late rebleeding that we see with the coagulation factor deficiency. You're not bleeding from superficial scratches, because we do have the temporary hemostatic plugs. Other things, menorrhagia. Menorrhagia is more of a feature of a coagulation deficiency than it is a platelet problem. So that's a big one. Menorrhagia is a real big one. And another one is the potential for hemarthroses, depending upon how severe your factor deficiency is. So hemarthroses and bleeding into closed spaces. Guys, I mean, to me, this is totally different than a platelet problem. Epistaxis, petechia, ecchymoses, bleeding from superficial scratches versus late rebleeding, menorrhagia. Also, I should have mentioned GI bleeds. GI bleeds a little bit more common with coagulation. GI bleeds and the potential for hemarthrosis. They don't have anything in common, the two of them. So how could you get anything wrong on an exam in being able to differentiate a coagulation factor deficiency versus platelet? I don't see how it's possible, because they're totally different in terms of the signs and symptoms. That's all based on knowing what normally happens when you screw up small vessels and you're injured. See, if you know the normal, then you can actually figure out the abnormal. Okay. So let's just finish off this concept of tests that we use for platelet abnormalities. First of all, we can do a platelet count. That'll tell us how many we have. Well, if you took an aspirin this morning or a non-steroidal, you still have a normal number of platelets, but I'll tell you what, they don't work. So just because you have a normal number doesn't mean the suckers work. Okay? Secondly, you can do bleeding time. Now, what's that really a good test for? Platelet function. Platelet function. Is there a test for von Willebrand's factor? Yes, there is. And unfortunately, they don't say von Willebrand factor assay. That would be nice and simple. It's what they call it, Ristaceton cofactor assay. I won't go through that story. All I'm just going to say is that if you're missing von Willebrand's factor, Ristaceton can't cause the platelets to clump. That's all I'm going to say. It's a fantastic test. The most sensitive test for diagnosing von Willebrand's disease is the Ristaceton cofactor assay. So you have three tests that involve platelets. Platelet count, bleeding time, and for von Willebrand's factor, the adhesion, glue for platelets, Ristaceton cofactor assay. You want to know how the acetone boards, part one? Want to know? So they had a patient that had chronic headaches, went into surgery, and an older guy that had osteoarthritis. That's what it was. He had osteoarthritis, and he went in and got his prostate, transurethral resection, you know, where they take out prostate chips, and he's bleeding to death afterwards. Okay, and so they said, what are you going to do? What's your treatment? Well, so you had to put a lot together. If you have osteoarthritis, you have pain, right? If you have pain, then you're more than likely going to be on a pain medication, okay, like a non-steroidal. Huh? They don't tell you that on boards. They make you try to figure that out. And they'll even give you a couple tests. They say the proton is normal, the PTT is normal, and the platelet count's normal. And they say, this guy's bleeding at death. And you say, oh, my God, I don't know what to do. I don't know what's going on here. Oh, you should. You should. You took non-steroidal. They're going to have a normal proton and PTT. That's a coagulation factor test. They're going to have a normal platelet count, but they don't work. So how are you going to treat them? Platelet pack transfusion. Because when you give them platelets from a donor, they are able to work. Okay? The patients can't work, but donor units of platelets can work, and it'll stop the bleeding. That's the way they ask the question on boards. I actually had a case exactly like that in a hospital. And the patient got 20 units of blood and almost died before the urologist came down and talked to me. Proton was normal, PTT was normal, Platelet count was normal. The guy was bleeding to death. And I said, did you do it? Did you ask him what medications he was on? I said, did you ask him if he was on aspirin or nonsteroidal? See, I knew what was going on, so I had my friend Bajo Bustani go up there and do a bleeding time before that idiot ever got down to my office. Turned out the bleeding time, he calls me 15 minutes later, he says it's still bleeding. Okay? So then I said, your guy was on aspirin, nonsteroidal, buddy. I said, what you're going to do is give him about 5 units of platelets and your patient will be fine. Just like that, stop bleeding. They asked that exact question, it's kind of interesting, that exact question that happened to me was the question they asked on the boards. Okay? So if you're taking platelets, do any of them work right? Have you taken nonsteroidals? Any of them working right now? No. And if you had some major surgery and you were bleeding to death, okay, what would be the only treatment for you? Take, get normal platelet transfusion. That is correct. Good. Okay, let's break.